It's Thursday, the 13th of June, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Doctors at Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania performed a successful transplant operation on 10-year-old Sarah McGurnan. Sarah McGurnan is the little 10-year-old girl whose parents last week went before a federal judge in order to demand a change in the protocols for organ transplantation in order that their daughter, who was only age 10, could be placed on par with adults in terms of ranking for getting very scarce lungs available for transplantation. As many medical ethicists across the country have now made very clear, this is a judicial intervention into a very highly tuned and very highly sensitive transplantation protocol, and one that means that a judge, in this case, has intervened for one patient, putting the lives of other patients at risk. From a worldview perspective, there are a host of issues, all of them excruciating. The most important of these issues is the shortage of organs for transplantation. The shortage is particularly acute when it comes to lungs. Little Sarah has an advanced case of cystic fibrosis, and doctors and her parents agreed that if a lung transplant procedure was not done quickly, she would die, perhaps in just a matter of days. We should be very thankful that at least in the case of this young girl, the transplant operation appeared to be not only possible, but after it was conducted, successful. But doctors had to cut down donor lungs from an adult in order to make them fit the chest cavity of the 10-year-old girl, increasing the likelihood of the failure of the transplant. As many ethicists have pointed out, this also means that another patient, similarly near death, was denied the lungs that otherwise could have gone to that patient. Sally Satel, writing an op-ed in the pages of USA Today, points to the fact that one of the most difficult of these issues is, of course, the shortage of organs. And she suggests, as she is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, that at least one of the reasons why these organs are so scarce is that there is not an allowance for a financial incentive for donors to make such organs available. That financial incentive is not only something that is ruled out of bounds by medical ethics in the United States, it is actually also against the law. A 1984 federal law known as the National Organ Transplant Act makes it illegal to give or to acquire an organ for material gain. As Satel writes, a revision of the law would allow experimentation with incentives. For organs such as lungs and hearts, the donor must be deceased. Perhaps an individual could agree to donate his organs at death in exchange for a burial benefit or a contribution to his estate. The government or a charity could pay for the benefit. Satel then asks, would such incentives work? There is good reason to be optimistic, she argues, but we need research to be sure. One thing is sure, our transplant system is an unqualified failure, she argues. More than 118,000 patients are waiting for kidneys, livers, lungs, and hearts. Every day, 18 of the individuals on that list die as they wait. From a Christian worldview perspective, the allowance for financial gain for donating organs is perhaps attractive in terms of the pragmatics of the situation, but extremely ominous and suspect when it comes to the ethical quandaries that this would inevitably produce. For instance, if there is a free market for donated organs, would they not eventually go to those who have the greatest capacity to pay? And furthermore, as medical ethicists have looked at the situation, they understand that it would be very difficult to maintain a clear line between voluntary donation and something that would be coerced, if by nothing else, by financial pressure. In other parts of the world, the availability of organs on something like a free market is more common, and there are huge problems that have emerged with this. For instance, there are organ thieves in some countries. In some cases, individuals have been kidnapped or even killed so that their organs could be removed. The free market for organs has also created a major problem in China, where there are documented accusations of the fact that prisoners are being executed so that their organs can be removed. And, of course, there is another story out of China, and that is of a teenage boy who sold one of his kidneys so that he could gain enough money to buy an iPad. But even as we bring these thoughts to a close, we close not on the issue of the fact that there are so many ethical problems involved in organ transplantation, especially with an organ shortage. We need to end by recognizing that in Philadelphia, there is a 10-year-old girl who has just received a new lease on life. And we have to hope that for this little girl, little Sarah Murnahan, this lung transplant will give her a new lease on life. In terms of national issues, we can now expect a very intense national debate over the question of immigration reform. As the New York Times reports, on Tuesday of this week, the United States Senate voted overwhelmingly to begin debating a new immigration measure. And as the Senate voted to do so, President Obama has offered a wholehearted endorsement of the bipartisan proposal. As reporters Mark Landler and Ashley Parker reflect, for Mr. Obama, who has picked his shots in the immigration debate to avoid stirring partisan anger on Capitol Hill, it was a moment of promise and peril. While he threw his weight behind the bill, he conceded that it would not satisfy all sides and said he anticipated a bruising fight over issues like border security and the path to citizenship. They go on to say the president, however, may have more leverage than in previous battles, not least because many Republicans believe rewriting the immigration laws is critical for the long-term viability of their party, given the nation's demographic shifts, even if doing so risks alienating parts of their base. So now we can finally look forward to a very focused debate in the United States Senate. The Senate is the crucial body at this point, where 8 senators have been working together to forge at least an attempted bipartisan issue of immigration reform. That proposal is now going to go before the Senate, and a month-long period of very intense debate is sure to follow. But the most important debate in this country is probably not the one that will take place in the United States Senate, and eventually also in the House of Representatives. The most important debate over the issue of immigration reform in this country will take place among American citizens. And this is the point at which American citizens can make their voice known. The issue of immigration reform should be one of great importance to every American, and especially to evangelical Christians, who must recognize that even as so many other issues come with moral clarity, this one comes with a great deal of moral confusion and complexity. We're going to have to think very carefully about the issue of immigration reform, about how Christian moral principles should apply in such a complex situation, and how we should envision a future for the United States that will involve the fact that we should be grateful that we are a nation receiving so many immigrants rather than the kind of nation so many people are trying to leave. At least to this point, many American politicians have been trying to avoid the issue. But with the Senate now voting overwhelmingly to take the issue as a major point of its legislative concern, for all legislators, especially the 100 members of the United States Senate, there will be no place to hide. We reported yesterday on the fact that the Obama administration has surrendered on the issue of the emergency contraceptive and its availability over the counter to women and girls of all ages. Now in the pages of USA Today, there is an interesting exchange, a debate of sorts, between two figures who have a very high investment in this controversy. The first is Cora Colette Bruner, who is a spokeswoman for the American Academy of Pediatrics. She's also the co-author of its policy statement supporting emergency contraception. The second is Anna Higgins, director of the Center for Human Dignity at the Family Research Council. USA Today asked both of these women a series of questions. And going to the end of this debate, the questions get particularly interesting. USA Today asks, what are the drawbacks of this new policy? Bruner said, it costs $40 to $60 for one pill. The costs need to come down. It needs to be available at a cost that is not prohibitive to less than 17-year-old sexually active women. I would encourage state Medicaid to continue to cover this. Let's pause for a moment to consider what this woman, a spokeswoman for the American Academy of Pediatrics, has just said. First of all, she's referring to females under the age of 17 as women, and in this case, as sexually active women. But if you listen carefully to her argument, she went far beyond this. She's actually arguing that there should be taxpayer support for the availability of this emergency contraceptive to women of any age, including girls much younger than 17. In other words, she now demands that emergency contraceptives not only be made available to girls of any age without a prescription, over the counter, without any kind of parental notification or permission, she now demands that it be financially subsidized and paid for, in the case of Medicaid, by the state. Recall her words, it needs to be available at a cost that is not prohibitive for less than 17-year-old sexually active women. Just imagine all the worldview implications loaded into those few words. Higgins responded, "We're putting the safety of young girls at risk and trampling on the rights of parents. We need to encourage parent-teen communication on medical and moral issues of sexual behavior." Then, very tellingly, USA Today asks a very important question. Does the emergency contraceptive pill, Plan B, cause abortion? Bruner responded, "Scientists have shown repeatedly that it does not cause abortion. With emergency contraception over the counter, there hopefully will be fewer abortions because kids won't get pregnant. About 10% of female teens," she writes, "who have sex are forced to, and this provides the chance to have contraception in that unfortunate circumstance," end quote. What we need to note in this case is that Ms. Bruner has significantly shifted the terms of debate. Ask a question about whether the pill causes abortion, she quickly suggests that, quote, "scientists have repeatedly shown that it doesn't cause abortion," but then she changes the issue to emergency contraceptives being available over the counter, especially for teens who have sex that is coerced. That wasn't the question. Higgins responds, "That's inconclusive. The Plan B one-step label says it, quote, is believed to act as an emergency contraception primarily by preventing ovulation or fertilization. In addition, it may inhibit implantation. It is not effective once the process of implantation has begun," end quote. Higgins is then emphatically correct when she writes, "What that says to us is that it could possibly act as an abortive drug, but there are insufficient studies to establish that," end quote. That is a very fair statement, and one that should send grave concern into the minds of anyone concerned for the sanctity of human life. Furthermore, American parents should note carefully that the spokeswoman in this case was representing the American Academy of Pediatrics. Far too many American parents taking their children to pediatricians assume that the pediatric community is without any particular moral agenda. Well, when it comes to the American Academy of Pediatrics, that moral agenda is shockingly present. Yesterday, we took note of the fact that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is absolutely determined to make late-term abortions legally available to the women of that state. Andrew Cuomo is now pushing a very radical abortion agenda, and one of the things we noted in this consideration is that there is a geographic distinction in this country. As there was in 1973, before the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the Roe v. Wade decision, and that geographic distinction continues now. 28 states have moved to restrict abortion in some manner. And as I'm reporting to you now from the city of Houston, Texas, Governor Rick Perry in this state, in a direct contrast to Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York, has now added the issue of abortion restrictions to a special called section of the Texas legislature. As the Houston Chronicle reports, for the second time in as many days, Governor Rick Perry expanded the scope of the legislature's special session, adding to the agenda an issue sure to ignite fiery fights in the House and the Senate, abortion. In announcing his call for the legislature to consider increased restrictions on abortions, Governor Perry said, quote, "In Texas, we value all life, and we've worked to cultivate a culture that supports the birth of every child. We have an obligation to protect unborn children and to hold those who peddle these abortions to standards that would minimize the death, disease, and pain they cause," end quote. One of the things we should carefully note in comparing the stances of Governor Perry in Texas and Governor Cuomo of New York is the radical contrast and distinction in the very language they use. In his comments published in the New York Times, Governor Cuomo never even mentioned a baby, either born or preborn. Meanwhile, Governor Perry, in calling for increased restrictions on abortion, went right to the heart of the issue, speaking of our societal responsibility to protect life at every stage, including unborn human life. He went so far as to mention the word child, and to do so repeatedly. We should note very carefully that that word almost never appears in the language of those who are pushing for abortion rights. Finally, the Houston Chronicle also ran another article, this one a column on an issue that is absolutely rich with worldview implications. Columnist Lisa Falkenberg writes about the issue of school choice. She begins her article with these words, quote, "On this issue, I'm a hypocrite. Let's just get that out of the way. Anyone who has a problem with public school choice for other people's children, yet has the means to choose schools for their own kids, speaks with a forked tongue." In the state of Texas, as in many other states, parents are increasingly demanding school choice, the development of charter schools, and other alternatives. Of course, school choice also refers to an entire universe of choices, ranging from homeschooling to private schooling, Christian schools, and many other new alternatives. Falkenberg is very concerned about the children who do not have a choice. She writes, I think the concern comes down to this. In our brave new world of choice, what happens to the kids who never get one? No, she writes, not the 100,000 kids on charter school waiting lists, the kids who will never make it on that list, the kids whose parents are too uninvolved or unaware or overwhelmed to ever put them on that list. She writes about several of the issues involved in the morality of education, especially the education of children. She writes, for example, about schools that have largely been evacuated by talented students. In other words, there are no students to help form an incentive or model for students who are performing at a lower level. But she also writes about the immorality of forcing gifted and talented students to remain in schools that are simply not delivering a quality education. There is no easy answer to this, and she recognizes it. On this question, she quotes a former principal, Paul Castro, as saying, quote, I don't think that question has an answer that doesn't make people get the willies, end quote. In other words, any way you go with that kind of question, there is no good or safe or satisfying answer. She also writes about the fact that politically, many of the people who disapprove of and oppose the issue of school choice have actually made choices for their own children, including President Obama and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, both of whom oppose this kind of school choice policy, but have chosen to put their own children into very expensive private schools. She openly questions the morality of standing for one thing in terms of public policy and making a very different decision with one's own children. Nevertheless, the most difficult issue she confronts in her article is the one about those kids who are left behind. In her words, the kids who will never make it on a list. The kids whose parents are too uninvolved or unaware or overwhelmed to ever put them on that list. The list being a list for charter schools and schools that will give those children increased educational options. This columnist is clearly pointing to a very real and present problem, a vexing problem, and one that all of us must take seriously. We should all be concerned for those children who do not have parents who are able to speak as their advocates in education or in many other dimensions of life. But the sad reality that has to come to us from a Christian worldview is that there is no replacement. There simply can't be an adequate replacement for parents where parents do not fulfill their responsibility. In the words of this columnist, she speaks of the kids whose parents are too uninvolved or unaware or overwhelmed to ever put them on a list of priority. But the issue here is also parents who are absolutely absent, absent from their children's lives, absent from the household and the family context, and absent from moral responsibility when it comes to the raising of their own children. In recent months, we discussed controversies over such questions as to whether children whose parents are involved in their education have an unfair advantage over children who lack such parents. That question will be very morally offensive to those parents who are deeply and integrally involved in the lives and education of their children. But there's another insight here that is absolutely crucial from a Christian worldview. Nothing, no one, no organization, no well-intended school system, no government can replace, fully and comprehensively, a missing parent, an uninvolved parent, an overwhelmed parent, or a parent who simply doesn't care. There isn't a government on earth that can replace a parent. Not a single parent. Not even one. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Houston, Texas, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.